Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2013 Home Education Conference held at Southern Virginia University.
My name is Ariel, or Ariel. You can say it like the crab says it, if you want.
Okay.
For them.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, good idea. Okay, so my name is Ariel Rodriguez. I'm a professor of family and child development here at Southern Virginia University. I'm a homeschooler, like I said, and I love this place, and I just want to put in a shameless plug. All three of my kids have come here, and they love it. One of my children just graduated. She was the salutatorian at the graduation ceremony. She got to sit on the stand next to Mitt, and she was very excited about that. Okay, so let's jump into this. I don't have a lot of time, and my goal is to move as quickly through the material as possible so that we can do question and answer, or maybe even some role play about how you field questions about socialization. So here we go. A good friend of mine, Jeff Hill, he's a professor at BYU in their Marriage, Family, and Human Development program. He once offered me this really insightful observation. He said, a lot of people who homeschool do it because of the socialization that happens in the public schools. Right? I don't know if you can make out that picture, but there's a little boy there who's hanging by his backpack on a hook, and he's just like, yeah, anyway. At the same time, a lot of people who oppose homeschool do it because of the socialization that happens in the public schools. Right? This really got me thinking. I thought, you know, obviously both can't be right, but it's funny that I would find myself having these conversations with people where they would raise concerns about socialization and say, as if the public school was this wonderful place for socialization, and that was one of the reasons why we didn't want to homeschool our kids. Now, I know people homeschool for lots of different reasons, but that's certainly one of the concerns. Anyway, so this is sort of the nature of the beast. Anyone who homeschools in America will have to deal with questions about socialization sooner or later. What do you say to your friends and family who raise these concerns? How do you respond to those questions? Or maybe if you're really new at homeschool, maybe you're wondering, what if they're right? Can homeschooling put my child at risk for poor social development? Is there some sort of special precautions I should take? So these are the kind of issues I want to deal with. Okay. So my purpose here is to help you understand the big picture of socialization as a developmental process so that you can, first of all, talk to neighbors, friends, and family about their concerns as they raise concerns about socialization. And second of all, better facilitate your children's healthy socialization. Now, if you're really new to homeschooling and you haven't really dealt with this issue yet, you may not be aware of all those socialization people who are going to jump out of the woods and raise all these questions and concerns, but it really does happen. I teach here at Southern Virginia, and I get to teach classes like parenting and family relationships kind of stuff, and homeschooling comes up a lot. And I'm always surprised at just how intolerant, I'd say, about half the class is about homeschool. I've never encountered, there's no other topic that I've ever encountered in any of the classes I teach. I mean, we deal with ethnicity issues and all kinds of other things, and there's never been any kind of intolerance on any issue except for homeschool. I just find that fascinating. So it does happen. You will have to deal with it, and that's sort of what I want to help you with today. So first of all, we're going to talk about socialization basics. Okay, there's a homeschool researcher. His name's Richard G. Medlin. He says, you know, when lay people talk about socialization, when they say, well, what about socialization? They mean lots of different things. Sometimes when people talk about socialization, they're talking about social activity, giving children a chance to play and participate in sports, dance team, scouting, all that kind of stuff, right? Another way in which people talk about socialization is they'll talk about it as an issue of social exposure. It's important to expose your children to different cultures and different values and different all that kind of stuff, right? And then sometimes when they're talking about socialization and they're raising concerns, they're talking about social influence, teaching children to conform to society's norms. Like you need your kid to go to school so they can learn how to behave like the right kind of person, right? So what I want to do is share with you a definition that is sort of like a scientific definition. This isn't the most scientific-y one. Would have too much verbiage in it that would be kind of not too understandable, but this is one that I took out of one of my textbooks. The process by which parents and others ensure that a child's standards of behavior, attitudes, values, and skills conform to those deemed appropriate by society. So ultimately, socialization is about how do you get little kids to grow up to be healthy, happy, normal, big people who are productive members of adult society. All right, that's what we're looking at. How do you, that process by which children are socialized to grow up and be the kind of people we want them to be. So, behaviors, for example, we socialize our children on things like swearing, talking in theaters, praying, eating with utensils, dressing and grooming standards. attitudes towards women, minorities, eating vegetables, math, authority figures, right? Does any one of you have an attitude about math? Sometimes people do. Values like the sanctity of life, family, freedom, honesty, education, religion, we share with... Oh, my family came in. Okay, well, they too late for them. Skills like communication, conflict resolution, making your bed, bargain shopping. We teach our kids all kinds of skills. These are all the kinds of things that happen in the course of our life as we interact with our children. We socialize them, right? Okay, so more basics. The agents of socialization. There are lots of different agents who socialize children. Parents, siblings, teachers, coaches, friends, clergy, peers, groups, peer groups, and media. I want to just draw your attention to the fact that I separated friends from peer groups, because we're going to see that those have two different effects on children. Different agents affect different aspects of socialization to different degrees. For example, having a parent or older sibling who smokes more strongly predicts children's smoking than does having peers or friends who smoke. Right? Hopefully it makes sense to you, but you can see the idea there. Some of the agents of socialization have a stronger impact on different aspects of a child's life. For example, if you've got a 14-year-old daughter, odds are you're going to have less influence over what she wants to wear and the music she wants to listen to than you are going to have over whether she wants to go to church or not, whether she is a conservative or a liberal, politically speaking, things like that. So some things you have more influence over and some things you have less. Okay, so let's talk about socialization across development. We'll start with early childhood. The first thing I want to tell you is parents are the key. Okay, so parents are, first of all, there's several ways in which parents are really influential in socialization. They are interactive partners. Okay, so you, first of all, you interact with your kids, right? You play with them, you perform activities with them, you do chores with them, you do all kinds of, in all kinds of ways. I mean, even starting from just toddlers, talking with them, and you know, playing, you know, all the little, even babies, you know, like the little peekaboo and all that stuff. You're an interactive partner, and that's important. You're an instructor. Parents teach kids about how to make your bed or how to use the fork. There's all kinds of things that we do to teach our children. Resources. Parents provide lots of resources that then enable children to become more socialized, right? Examples of resources would include things like providing Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers so that children can learn their ABCs and things like that, right? And get lessons from Mr. Rogers about how to be nice to people and stuff like that, right? Managers. Parents are managers of the children's social life. So you do things like organize playgroups. So managers, the idea that you're going to manage your kids' social life. You're going to get them, for example, what do we do as LDS people? It's almost like funny to me. One of my daughters pointed out to me, Dad, it's kind of weird, but like every Mormon kid has a musical instrument and a sport and maybe some other like dance or something. You know, like we get them these certain things that they can go do and develop their talents and all that kind of stuff. But we manage them into groups and activities that are going to socialize them even further, right? Okay, play is another important thing that happens to socialize children. That happens in the home. That is something that parents do. So play with siblings, play with friends, play with peers. I really should have put play with dad in there somewhere. Let me just tell you, I would love to give a full hour-long presentation about why it's important for dads to play with kids. That would be awesome. And there's enough research to fill an hour, but we won't do that today. But just play is good. It's very good for kids. It provides information about the world outside the family, right? Play is an opportunity to practice skills, including social skills. I remember my kids playing Beanie Babies, right? I don't know if any of you, your kids are maybe too young if you're just starting out at homeschool, but my kids would play Beanie Babies, and they would like, they'd take little roles, and they'd act out little scenarios, and they'd be like having conflicts and negotiating those conflicts and making friends and practicing all these skills. It was kind of fun to watch. I thought, wow, this is good, right? Also, play with siblings, friends. Play is a standard for comparison. It provides a standard for comparison. When you play, you get feedback. The child gets feedback about their developing abilities and gets to compare themselves to others. Right? So those are some of the ways in which play is helpful. Socialization in middle childhood. Parents are still key. There's less interaction between parents and children, generally speaking. Now, keep in mind, most of the research I'm going to talk about is not about homeschoolers. All right, because I think obviously there'd be an exception there. Like homeschool parents probably have a lot more interaction with their kids than public school parents. But what I'm talking about is just the mainstream, the research that's out there on most kids in America. So parents are less involved in direct interaction, but all the other stuff's still happening, right? Supportive friendships become important. And when I say supportive friendships, I mean, friendships that don't involve conflict, that don't involve coercion, not a one-sided friendship, but a good friendship that supports your child, that becomes really important as an agent of socialization for your children. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Middle childhood, more middle childhood. Friendships fulfill six important functions in a child's life at this point. First of all, companionship. You know, kids have varying needs for companionship. Some of your kids might have a really high needs. Some of your kids might have lower needs for companionship. But most kids want some sort of companionship. Stimulation. Stimulation. That's all the stuff that you're too tired to do with your kids. You're glad that they have friends that they can go do all that stuff with, right? So they have all kinds of interesting information they get from their friends, excitement, amusement, all kinds of high-energy activities. Physical support. So friends provide resources and assistance to each other. And I don't know how to... Okay. I had a really good example of resources. Just the idea that your friend has different games and different toys and different things that you go over to their house and do those things, and they come over to your house and do your things. And yeah, so you broaden your network of resources. Ego support. When I say ego, I'm talking not about like pride ego, but in the Freudian sense, like the ego is the individual, the interpersonal needs, right? So the ego support is about supporting their interpersonal needs. Support, encouragement, and feedback that helps children feel competent, attractive, worthwhile, just feel good about themselves, right? And then social comparison. We've already talked about this, the importance of understanding where you stand compared to others. Friendship provides that. And then intimacy and affection, warm, close, trusting relationships that include self-disclosure. Now, that may sound like a girl thing, but boys actually do that too. Girls maybe hug, boys wrestle, right? But it's all the same thing. There's a lot of physical contact and there's a lot of connection and support that happens there. Socialization in adolescence. Parents are still key, and there's less interaction basically interaction between you and your child continues to decline. Some of that's normal, and again, I don't think it'll happen to every homeschool family. But there's less interaction and instruction now, but all those other first points that I laid out in early childhood, those are still happening. Adolescents have an increased need for companionship and reassurance of self-worth, right? As they go through puberty and hormones happen and cognitive advances happen that allow them to get really confused about their identity, and in all kinds of ways, they start wanting more assurance that they're okay. So, friendships in adolescence. Adolescents increasingly depend on friendships to meet their needs for companionship and reassurance of self-worth. So the ups and downs of their friendships increasingly shape their well-being. Does anyone here have adolescents who can, like, testify to that, right? Like, amen, brother? Like, yes. Isn't it odd when your kids become teenagers how friendships become so much more important? And depending on how things are going in their friendships, that has to do with how well they're doing in their life. Again, the quality of the friendship matters, supportive, not conflicted or coercive. Peers, okay, peer pressure to resist parental influence peaks in adolescence. We all know that, but it's just nice to see it there, see that scientists discovered that it's true, right? Those scientists are smart people. Conformity to peers peaks at about 8th or 9th grade. I don't know if you remember that, but there was this phase in your life, if you go way back in the Wayback Machine, 8th or 9th grade, you really wanted to fit in. But by the time you were in 10th or 11th or 12th grade, you were way too cool to do what the crowd was doing, and you wanted to, like, do your own thing, right? So there is this sort of hump there, and then it kind of peters off. But that's as bad as it gets, that idea of the peers having a lot of influence on your kids. That should be happening 8th or 9th grade. Here's an interesting graph. This is from a study of self-disclosure across these sort of from second grade to college, right? And what you have is the green, I don't know if you can tell, maybe I ought to go over there and point real quick. This line is supposed to be green, that's parents, and this line is friends. And you get that crossover. And again, as I've been saying, that's for public school kids, but you can see the idea that your kids start to disclose a lot more to their peers, start to interact more and share more things with their peers. Doesn't mean they stop sharing with you, but there's a lot of things in their life that they share with their peers that they feel more comfortable sharing with peers than with you. Friends. Right. So friends are important. So conclusions about the big picture on socialization. Parents matter most. That's conclusion number one. You really are important. Research supports the consensus that parents have the strongest influence on socialization, particularly with respect to children's values, which is a good thing. What it means for us as LDS people is that the things that we care the most about are the things that we have the most influence over. Right. So we should be happy about that. Second point, parents have the broadest influence on children's socialization. They manage the influence of friends, peer groups, media, and other agents of socialization. So that role as manager is really important, and it allows you to have an incredible amount of influence in your children's lives. There's one more point that isn't directly related to all this developmental psychology stuff, but it's still really important. The parents' marriage has a powerful influence on children's socialization. So, for example, the quality of the parents' marriage predicts social skills with peers on the playground in first grade. And those social skills with peers on the playground in first grade predicts friendships and popularity in junior high. And friendships and popularity in junior high is going to predict dating, the end of their high school career and the beginning of their college career, the quality of their dating relationships. And the quality of their dating relationships at that point in their life is going to predict in adulthood their adult relationships, their marriage, their parenting. So you have this long-term impact of your marriage on your children's lives. Incredible impact on socialization. Okay, conclusion number two. Supportive friendships are essential. So, supportive friendships provide skills, practice, information, stimulation, personal resources, ego support, companionship. We've already said this stuff, self-worth, and a standard for appropriate social comparisons. Right? Here's an important point. I guess I should have made this like in bright red or something. Friendships buffer children from negative peer group influence. Right? If maybe some of you have personal experience with this. Think of a time in your career in grade school or junior high or high school when you didn't have friends and how much harder it was to survive and manage your world in school. Right? Friendships are the thing that helps you to navigate that world. Right? We'll come back to that. Okay, so friendships versus family relationships. I guess this next little bit here is really important. This is from Piaget, who was one of these big, the father of child development kind of a guy. And he said that there's something about friendships that's different than family relationships. And this is essential to understand why children actually need friendships and why family relationships don't work. He says, structurally speaking, friendships are just different than family relationships. And there's things that happen in friendships that make them much more helpful to children's development. First of all, they're freely chosen. I don't have choice who my brother is. My 18-month older brother Manel, he was really annoying. He would hit me and beat me and take my toys and do all kinds of bad things, right? And I didn't get to choose him, right? But my friends were my friends because I chose them. And if they started treating me like that, what would I do? I would say, I'm not going to be your friend anymore. So there's a sense in which the voluntary nature of friendships means that both parties have to try harder and practice more skills to keep the relationship going. Right? So this is a really important deal. The next point, there's a balance of power in friendships usually. The nature of a coercive friendship is one that one of the members has all the power and the other one doesn't. Right? But what we're talking about is in a supportive friendship, there's a balance of power. Right? It's not like I dominate the relationship or you dominate the relationship. Now, I'm not saying parent-child relationships do tons of really good stuff. I'm not saying you can't have a great relationship with your child and have a lot of open communication, all kinds of neat stuff, but the reality is when there's a balance of power, conflict resolution becomes more like real life, right? Like, okay, like it's you and me and you're not my boss and you're not my mom and you can't tell me what to do and we got to work this out, right? The third point, this sense of positive mutuality. There's a sense in which in a friendship you have to maintain the positive feelings or the friendship doesn't survive. In family relationships, that's not necessarily true. Some days I hated my brother, and some days I loved my brother, and it was kind of a mixed bag, right? But in friendships, for the most part, it better be positive, or else I'm not gonna wanna be in that friendship. So there's a greater pressure on both partners to maintain positivity in the relationship and practice skills about maintaining positivity in relationships, which is really good, right? So for these reasons, friendships are really important, and we wanna make sure that our children have supportive friendships in their lives. Okay, let's go on. So now we're going to talk about misconceptions about socialization. Misconception number one, and I've got lines drawn through it, so I don't want anyone to think it's true. Right? It's not true. Friendships and peer groups are the same. That is a misconception. The influence of friends is different from the influence of peers. Okay? Unstructured, unsupervised peer group activity, the kind of stuff that happens on a playground, at school sometimes, particularly during early adolescence, pressures children to conform, creates stress for children, and generates a negative dynamic, sort of an antisocial influence in their lives. The peer group is often about getting children to discount the adult agents of socialization, right? Parents, teachers, coaches. The peers are there together coming up with ideas and plans that are about doing things that adults would not approve of a lot. In other words, you very easily, we've got research showing that you throw a bunch of kids together and it's much more easy to form a negative dynamic than a positive dynamic. If you're, for example, in a rehab center for teenagers, they have to do all kinds of work to create a positive dynamic among the teenagers on that unit. But if you just leave them alone, you get a negative dynamic pretty easily. It sort of seems to be the natural state of affairs, right? Kind of like Lord of the Flies or something, I don't know. Friendships buffer children from the negative effects of peer influence. So what I want to suggest to you is that peer influence, again, the kind I'm talking about is unstructured, unsupervised, like not like young women's and young men's on Wednesday night or something. That's perfectly fine because adults are there and the adult agents of super socialization are making sure that good stuff happens, that the kids are practicing good skills, engaging in, you know, appropriate activities and stuff, right? They're monitoring behavior, they're providing feedback. But unstructured activities, not a good thing, right? The kinds of interactions that happen in the hallways at school, on the playground, there's negative things that will happen, and your friends are the things that buffer you from those negative influences, that help you to not cave and conform, or that help you to deal with just the stresses and pressures of all of it, right? So friendships are important, and they're not the same as peer groups. Misconception number two, socialization alone explains sociability, right? Okay, so here we go. I had someone come up to me once and say, man, we used to live next to a homeschool family, and they had two kids, and both those kids, man, they were just so socially like awkward. They were just kind of like social retards, right? And I'm a homeschooler, and I got three kids, and this person knows it. It's like, yeah, okay. How do you respond to that? Well, I said, you know what? I knew a public school kid once, and he was just so awkward. He was just kind of like totally socially retarded, and I'm pretty sure that school just messed him up, you know? The idea that decision alone, whether the kid is public schooled or homeschooled, is the deciding factor on whether or not the kid becomes like, I mean, is everybody, it's almost like, are we really going to think that everyone in public school is well-adjusted and popular and happy? And that's just a ridiculous thought, right? So there are a lot of other factors. Many factors influence sociability and social skills. Your choice about homeschool is not the only decision that's going to matter, right? The one I want to talk about just one of those factors today, and that is the idea of temperament. Temperament is just a thing that scientists study. Your children are born different, basically, right? Children are born different. Temperament is your child's pattern of behavior and emotional response to the environment. Children seem to be born with different temperaments, and we can classify those temperaments into different categories. And so here are some of the different scientists have come up with different ways of categorizing temperament. You've got this easy child, the difficult child, the slow to warm up child. Another group of researchers classified it in terms of the extroverted child, and then this other child who's sort of inhibited to unfamiliar experiences, right? He gets inhibited. Another group of researchers classified it in terms of extroversion, negative affectivity, and effortful control. But you get the idea. There's this different range of type of kid that Heavenly Father might have sent you, right? Temperament is generally stable across early childhood. It doesn't seem to be impacted by too many things. You can have an impact on it, though, as a parent. So here we go. Temperament. If you have a child who's like really pervasively shy and you're trying to help that child, here's the idea. It's not the child's temperament that predicts their temperament in adulthood. It's the goodness of fit between your parenting style and the child's temperament that predicts their temperament in adulthood, right? So the way you handle the temperament is more important. So let's think about it. You've got the difficult child, right? And I think everybody knows about the difficult baby and how you have to respond, and you have to provide them with more attention and care, and you sort of have to adapt what you're doing to that child's temperament and their moods and the things that kind of wreck their day. You know, the difficult temperament child is a child, if you've ever taught primary, it's that child that when you say, hey, kids, it's a beautiful day outside. Today we're going to go have our lesson outside. And all the kids go, yay! And one kid goes, wait a minute, teacher, we can't do that. We're supposed to have class in here. And this kid starts getting all flipped out because you're violating his temperament. You're kind of creating this situation that's uncomfortable and different and new, and he likes routine and he likes predictability, right? So there's how you handle the temperament is what really matters anyway. Easy babies are not any less, that can still be a problem. What happens if you've got a super easy baby? The baby that just sits there in their little, that's just talking and having a good time all by themselves. Well, if you got a lot of other kids, you might ignore that baby. Right? And that might lead to problems. So there's different ways in which all these different babies have different challenges to them. Let's go on. Misconception number three, socialization is about conforming to peers. Okay. So at the heart of the socialization process is the idea that children are learning how to behave like adults. That's true, right? So how do children learn how to behave like adults? Is it because we're going to put them in the cafeteria in first grade with a bunch of other first graders? Is there a lot happening in the cafeteria in first grade that's teaching them about adult behavior? If I shrunk you guys down to little first grader size right now and put you in that cafeteria, would you know how to manage that situation? Maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. I don't know how much overlap there is between peer groups and adulthood, but here's what really helps children learn to behave like adults. Interacting with socially competent, supportive adults is the most important thing that children need to learn how to act like adults. Observing socially competent, supportive adults is also very important to them, and then receiving direct instruction from socially competent adults helps them. Right? Kids learn how to behave like adults because they have a lot of interaction and help from adults. That's what matters most. As I said with all the friendship stuff, there is stuff that happens with the peers, right? That's really important for them when they're adults and having the right skills for conflict and communication and all that kind of stuff. But there's a lot that adults help with. Okay, so more time with socially competent, supportive adults is always a good thing for children. Alternatively, learning to conform to peer behavior in the grade school cafeteria may have little overlap with learning how to behave like an adult. I just remember the trauma of like fifth and sixth grade cafeteria time. I mean, it wasn't like something that really helped me to be a better person and a better adult. So maybe I'm traumatized though, I don't know. Okay, so let's get to the strategies now. We'll talk about socialization strategies and then we'll talk about talking points when you're talking with people. And we might have time for questions and answers and all kinds of fun stuff. Okay, so first of all, you have to manage friendships. That's probably the most important message I want to give to you today is manage friendships. Make sure each child has at least one supportive friend. If your child doesn't have at least one supportive friend, that's not good for them. That's not going to, siblings can help and siblings can go a long way towards taking care of all this kind of stuff. If you have a lot of kids and they have really good friendships with their peers, that's going to help. But it'd be nice if each one of these kids could have a little friend outside of the family that's their friend that they can talk with and hang out with and practice all those skills with. Get them into groups and activities. And this is all kind of like, duh, you're already planning on doing this. I'm not telling you anything new. Get them into groups and activities that will increase their likelihood of finding supportive friendships. So again, it's not that they're in dance with a bunch of peers, but that they're in dance because they might form a friendship with one of the other kids in the dance class. That's your goal, right? There's nothing magical about just being with a bunch of other kids in a dance room, right? The goal is friendship. Small play groups, play dates, clubs, teams, lessons, all of these are ways in which you might help your children to find good supportive friendships, right? Another strategy, teach them about friendships. Give them direct instruction. Give them the social knowledge they need. Say things like, if you say nice things to the other children, they'll be more interested in being your friend. I remember literally once telling one of my daughters, you know, if you smile more, you know, that kind of stuff, right? When the other boys roughhouse with you, it's their way of saying they want to be friends. The trick is to not let things get too rough, right? But it's fun, and you go and you roughhouse with them, and just explain things like that, then little tiny lessons about relationships and how they work at their age, right? Another strategy, shy child. If you have a really pervasively shy child, I don't really have time to deal with that today. That would be another sort of 40-minute presentation, but here would be my thought to you. Read this book, Bernardo J. Carducci, The Shyness Breakthrough, a no-stress plan to help your shy child warm up, open up, and join the fun. It's a wonderful book based on some pretty solid research. Here's another thought. Normalize gender differences. High T boys and girls have lower needs for socializing and companionship. Girls generally have greater need for friendships, and friendships affect their well-being more intensely. This is not some sort of social difference between them. This seems to be biological. Testosterone, when people with high testosterone, boys and high T girls, experience stress, they're more likely to withdraw and isolate themselves. When girls with their higher serotonin levels experience stress, they seek support. They go seek people to connect with and seek comfort from. And so girls, in other words, in terms of their well-being, there's a direct, like, sort of biological connection we can see for why they need those friendships and why it influences their well-being so strongly, right? So there's going to be differences like that, and also there's going to be differences between individual kids. Like you might have a kid who just has higher needs for socialization, higher needs for social relationships. And so you just need to address that, right? That's, of course, going to peak in early adolescence. That's when they really start saying, I don't want to be in the house. I want to go out and find friends. I want to go do things with my friends. I want to, all that stuff. Strengthen your marriage. Okay, we talked about the importance of marriage. So aspects of your marriage that cross over into children's relationships with peers and friends include your conflict resolution. The way you manage your conflicts with your kids is the way they're going to manage conflicts with their peers. And so if you don't manage conflicts well, then that means they can't manage conflicts well with their peers. And that means they might not be able to make friends as easily, right? The level of aggression or violence in your relationship. Obviously, hopefully none of you have problems with that, but if you do, repent. Supportiveness. Making bids for support from your partner and accepting and receiving and responding to bids for support is a really important thing. If you have a lot of that going on in your marriage, that's great, and that's a good thing to model. By the way, talking about modeling, conflict resolution, it's okay to model that in front of your kids. It's okay to, research shows, I'm not just making this up, if you have a conflict that's well managed and resolved in front of your kids, it has no effect on them whatsoever that we can discover in research. It's only bad conflict and unresolved conflict that affects children negatively. So it's okay to have, I mean, you don't have to like go in the room every time, right? Because then your kids never get to see the conflict resolution. So it's okay to have discussions that are kind of like, well, no, I disagree. I think we ought to do it. And you have those kind of conversations. It's going to be actually maybe good for your kids. Communication. Your communication skills are going to predict how well your kids communicate with others. Okay, so talking strategies. Here we go. Wow. I have till 10 till? Okay. Pray for charity. I say that from experience. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you'll understand later. But yes, pray for charity. Sometimes it's kind of difficult to talk to people when they're talking to you about homeschool and socialization and all these concerns. Clarify their concerns before responding. Make sure that they are talking about socialization and find out what kind of socialization they're talking about and what specifically their concerns are so you can better address them. Convey an informed opinion. Review this handout that I've given you and maybe go do a little bit more research on your own and make sure you sound like you know what you're talking about. Describe the socialization process, sort of the way I've talked to you about it, some of the things that happen, the influences of parents and peers and friends and all that. Offer some conclusions, same kind of conclusions that I was offering. Parents matter most. Supportive friendships are essential. Those are the things that matter, and I'm taking care of that in my home school. Right? There you go. So, more talking strategies. Correct the misconceptions. Okay? Friendships and peer groups are not the same thing. Yeah, peers are important, and I know my kids... Okay. Homeschool kids don't spend as much time in same-age peer groups as public school kids. Duh, right? We kind of would expect that, right? But homeschool kids spend just as much time interacting with people in general as public school kids do. So the big difference between homeschoolers is not that homeschoolers are more isolated than public schoolers. It's that public schoolers spend more time with same-age peers, and homeschoolers generally spend more time with a range of age people that they interact with, right? So you can say, well, you know, they're not getting as much peer time, but they're getting friendships, and the friendships are a good influence. And by minimizing the unstructured peer time, I'm actually helping my kid, taking away some of the negative influence, right? So socialization alone does not explain sociability and social skills. Just remind them about the awkward, geeky kids that they knew in public school. Remind them about the fact that there are lots of factors that are going to influence kids' sort of, you know, sociability, personality. Socialization is not about conforming to peer behavior. That's not the goal. It's learning how to be like an adult. It doesn't matter right now if your kid isn't super good at fourth grade behavior. One of the things that happened to me constantly, as my kids went out into the world and interacted with other people while they were growing up, I would get these comments. I remember one of my favorite comments was someone who came over to our house once and said, I was talking with your son, Nathaniel, who was like, I think, 11 at the time. He said, and I actually had a conversation with him. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, like, we talked. Like, it was weird. It was like talking to an adult. We had this conversation, like, and he seemed to be with me and interacting in the way that an adult would act. And I said, oh, yeah, he's homeschooled. That happens, right? you put him in with the fourth graders, and he might not know everything. It might take him a while to pick up on how to manage the cafeteria. But you put him with adults, and he's there. Right? He knows how to act. He knows how to behave. He knows how to talk intelligently. He knows how to take interest in people. He knows how to do all kinds of things. Right? So, again, remind them of that goal. Okay, finally, read a good review of research. I did, just as an experiment, a couple of weeks ago, actually, I went to Google and I put in the terms homeschool socialization research and did a search. And then one of the top hits on Google is always the Google Scholar thing that takes you to scientific research. And I clicked on that and I got Richard G. Meldon, who did a review in 2000. It's old, but it was still good. I read it and it was really solid. Homeschooling and the Question of Socialization. It was very readable. It's published on an online journal. It's free to download, and it was just there for you. So you can go find things like that and read them. This is a peer-reviewed journal. In other words, other researchers read this thing and made sure it was kosher before he was allowed to publish it. Contrary to popular belief, these are two findings from his study. Contrary to popular belief, homeschooled children are not more socially isolated, and I've already told you about that. It's not that they have less contact with others. It's that they have more contact with adults and older kids and less contact with same-age peers. Another finding from his review, based on available studies, homeschooled children's socialization experiences are more effective than those of public school children in terms of producing conformity to social norms. Right. That's all I have for you. And so now what we should do is probably take some questions. We have about 3 minutes, I guess. Go ahead, please. Yeah, no, play's fine at that age. At that age, yeah, no. The kind of self-disclosure that's early puberty, 8, 9 years old, that's when you're going to start seeing them want to do a whole lot more disclosure and interaction, where support from the friend is going to really matter. But at this age, when they're doing their play, playing with beanie babies and make-believe and all that, they're still getting all that practice with social skills, so that's good. Other questions? Go ahead, please. To choose their friends?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're going to orchestrate, right? You're going to provide them, you're going to get them around other kids that are the kind of kids you want, would hopefully approve of for their friends, right? That's what you're the manager, right? So you provide them with opportunities and hopefully something will happen. You can't make it happen, but hopefully they'll connect with some kid and have a friendship there. And so the way you handle that is in terms of the groups that you're going to put them in the first place, right? Okay. Other questions? Go ahead. Yeah, oh, okay. I didn't write the title. I had a different title and it got changed and I'm not sure why. I guess grandparents in the sense that, if you came here because of the grandparents thing, I apologize. I guess it's the idea that your parents might be, like, what if you're trying to homeschool and your parents are saying, no, you can't do that, it's going to ruin the kid or something like that. I guess how to talk to your parents, maybe. I don't know. I didn't understand the title.
I just have a thought on that too. I know when I started, that was a big concern of my in-laws. And sometimes all you can do is just let time show them. And then my mother-in-law now is so proud that I homeschool. She brags to people about it. She's so impressed with the kids. But sometimes there's just going to be a period where they don't accept what you do. And you just live your life and show by example that it's a blessing for your family.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
I can tie this to grandparents, too.
Okay.
I was sitting with my in-laws last weekend and talked about this. And my father-in-law said, no, I went to high school in a very diverse situation where there was socioeconomic diversity and ethnical diversity. How can you, he just was saying you can't simulate that in a homeschool type situation. I'm not prepared. I wasn't here first, How can you respond to that, that he had to learn to work as a team with different kinds of people?
You can still, obviously, you could still channel your kids into activities where they have to do team building things, right? Or they could be in, dance club or scouts or anything like that could expose them to different people. But I just want to clarify, that's a misconception that if we had time, I would love to talk about. Exposing children, diversity in the classroom, different ethnicities, different religions, different everything, has not been shown scientifically to increase tolerance. Okay, I want to say that again. Exposing the kids to lots of different kinds of people does not increase tolerance. And in fact, there are a few studies at the college level that show that it increases intolerance. There's some research in college that shows that it actually increases intolerance to put kids in diverse settings. So the way kids learn tolerance is in the home. Okay, so you're the one that's going to help them to understand tolerance as an issue. And you can do that you can expose them to things and you can talk to them about it a lot, right? That's where kids get tolerance. Okay. Other questions? Go ahead. I'm not asking.
You know, just yeah. Know what was going on in my mind, insecurities and all this stuff. But my son here so much open, and we fight a little more. I get to feel what he's feeling, what he doesn't like, or like say something he enjoyed, or he likes a little girl. You know, we get to talk about that. With my daughter, I never had that. And honestly, we all learn.
Wonderful. Thank you for that comment. And research kind of backs up the idea of parental monitoring, the idea of knowing where your kids are. The most important variable that predicts your ability to know where your kids are is the quality of the relationship you have with them. If you have a warm and nurturing relationship with your children, they're more likely to tell you what's going on in their life. And that's really what parental monitoring is all about. It's not about keep giving them a GPS tracker. It's about having a good relationship so they'll talk to you. All right, I don't want to go over my time, and I think I did, so we should probably shut it down. But anyways, I'll hang around a bit if you want to ask more questions, but I've got a class at 11. Thank you.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.